Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for giving me this chance to present the paper. I'm really helpful to hear your comments. So the topic we're talking about is about the adoption of SFS 142, related how it affects acquisition performance. Okay. So this is a work with my colleague and a student in National Taiwan University. Okay. So everybody knows that M&A activity is very important. The firm, they grow internally or they can acquire target to develop the whole empire. So for M&A decision is very important for a company, and also because it involves a lot of interest and there involves a lot of information asymmetry and addressing problem. And also it's interesting because acquire day when they make announcement for their acquisition intent, usually we can see the market reaction. So it's easier for us to measure the acquisition performance. And most importantly, because there's goodwill arising from business combination. So later on the market, the shareholder manager can evaluate the M&A decision based on the subsequent of goodwill. Okay, so the information in the M&A here is that the accounting information provide, because acquire when they make a decision, they have to have a lot of information and to make a decision how much price they offer, what kind of method they want to do acquisition. And also in the active market M&A wave, and usually the, we cannot say the acquire overpaid, but usually the offer price is higher, so resulting in higher goodwill. So accounting standard, how accounting standard handle goodwill is important for manager, they make a decision for M&A acquisition. So that's why we want to investigate whether a standard SFMS adoption effect facilitate M&A performance. This is a little bit old. I thought this was a little bit old, year 2001, but compared with this, not that old. Yeah, because at the beginning, I was a little bit nervous. I was thinking it's an old topic, but I'm still thinking it's interesting. So talking about the 142, it's effective since year 2001, December 15. Actually, they put like an impairment only approach, because before 120, before that standard, managers, they have to recognize goodwill and amortize. They set up a useful life and amortize the goodwill over the useful life, cannot over 40 years. Okay. So, and under 142, there's very complicated, I think it's a very complicated way to handle the goodwill. They have to recognize goodwill and recognize and allocate the goodwill into the cash generating unit. And they have to do the two-step impairment test later. So during this kind of process, the company, the managers acquire have to collect other information, how they allocate goodwill to all the different cash generating units and how they evaluate the impairment loss later. Okay. So the prior literature like Chen at 2018, they're saying that because of this standard, so managers have to acquire much more information they never used before, so they can make their management forecast more accurate. And also however, there's some concern that from the practice also comments that they say the US standard, their two-step impairment loss test is too complicated and too difficult to, and also they involve some judgment and estimate. So managers usually can delay the goodwill impairment loss recognition. And usually when they have the CEO turnover, they recognize goodwill impairment loss rather than the goodwill actually already impaired and recognized. So there is a problem. So in 2018, actually the FASB, they issued some kind of discussion. They even thinking about introduce the amortization approach back to the goodwill accounting. And also they are saying, some comments saying that for goodwill amortization, they're saying that they treat the goodwill as the vesting asset. That means the usually the goodwill, the value of goodwill usually have the value start from the few years upon the beginning, the few years of the acquisition time period, and later on they just disappeared. So they are thinking another thing. They are thinking if the manager will set up a useful life, and they reveal some information, because acquire manager, they know like how much longer the value can extend for the goodwill. Okay, but a lot of comments actually consider how difficult the impairment loss tests are, and they are thinking to enrich more disclosures on impairment loss tests. Okay, so, and also ISB also have some kind of similar concern, and the issue about the goodwill issue always about the too small and too late. Okay, so that's why we're thinking about to consider whether the 142, the impairment loss, impairment only approach, whether it's a facilitate good MA performance. Okay. So I kind of skip. So usually for information in M&A, usually for the acquire has to know the change of the value of the acquire usually equal to the intrinsic value of the target plus the synergy between the acquire and the target, and they have to offer the setup offer price. Okay, so very difficult for acquire to set up offer price. Okay, so for target, they know their intrinsic value, but they don't know the synergy. But for acquire, they know the synergy. They probably know the synergy, but they don't know the intrinsic value of the target. But they have to come out the more accurate price to offer to make the company more beneficial. Okay, so the information here, based on the prior literature, they are saying that the accounting information, they can facilitate the reduced information asymmetry and the reduce the agency problem, and also the accounting standards can push your managers to acquire more information. So we're going to the standard, this trait about channel about the IS 142, just pushing the manager to acquire more information, because they have to do the impairment loss test. So before they acquire the target, they were thinking about how much they pay the goodwill, how they allocate the goodwill, and later on, because they have to be accountable for goodwill impairment loss. Okay, so first we argued that there's several papers talking about information effect of accounting change or accounting standard. Okay, so I just briefly talk about the before 142, there's 121. 121, of course, for the firm, they still recognize goodwill, but the goodwill allocates into the asset group level. But 142, they allocate to cash generating level. They're smaller units, so they don't have the offsetting problem, because they have to evaluate goodwill impairment within one unit instead of the group. So there is no offsetting problem. And also for 122, they don't provide a very significant guidance and the timing. So we need that 6 years, only 15 companies actually recognize goodwill impaired. So we are saying that and also for 142, they have to do two-step impairment loss test. First, every year, or if there's a indicator that the goodwill have some impairment, they have to do impairment loss test. So the first stage, they are thinking about whether the value of cash generating units is lower than the carrying value. And next step, they have to consider the goodwill at the cash generating unit level. So they do the two-step impairment loss. Okay, So that's why we're arguing that after 142, the company have to acquire more information. And also because 142, they eliminate amortization approach and only use the impairment approach. So impairment loss, kind of the significant significant indicator for investor know the company may make a wrong decision or make a poor M&A decision. So make it visible. So managers have to like really work hard. They have to think carefully the later on whether they'll show there's a significant indicator they have made a poor M&A. So that's why we argue that first, the managers have to acquire more information to know themselves. And secondly, to acquire more information to know the target, especially the synergy between the acquirer and the target, how they mix after the combination. And third, of course, this most importantly, we think that because SFA 142, they make the impairment loss is more significant, and the market will sort of discipline the managers if they make the wrong or poor M&A decisions. So we are saying that the adoption of 142, they may facilitate M&A decision and improve M&A performance. Okay. This is our first hypothesis. And second hypothesis, we're arguing that we kind of want to see the cross-sectional difference. Okay, so we are look at the prior literature, they are saying about some overconfident CEO. So they usually, based on their prior experience, they kind of a lot of successful experience. So that's why they overconfidence in their ability and they thinking they make a bit better decision also in M&A. So the prior literature shown that they usually overestimate their ability and overestimate the investment return. And they also prior literature, they also say they engage in M&A. They more intend to engage in M&A when they have more cash in there, or they engage in M&A more complicated M&A, like cross-sectional M&A, cross-border M&A. So we are arguing that because of the managers, this kind of managers, but SFA 142, first they push the overconfidence CEO, they acquire more information. The second, of course, they kind of discipline because if they made the wrong decision or made a poor decision or they're too aggressive in M&A activities, then they're more, the market will know. So we are arguing that the second hypothesis we argue this kind of discipline mechanism is stronger for firm they have higher, they have overconfidence CEO. So we compare with the positive association between adoption 142 and acquisition performance is more stronger for firm they have overconfidence CEO. Okay, so there's also research design. So we just combine the our sample periods between the 1998 to 2001 is a period and the post period 2002 to 2005. Of course, we try to do robustness check to exclude 2002, but the results still the same. So we draw all the combination M&A from ACDC sample database, and we set up some criteria. For example, the acquirer must to hold less than 50% of the target. After acquisition, they have to hold 100% of the target, more than 90% of the target. And also the process have to be complete because some acquire, they make announcement, but later on they don't really complete the acquisition. Okay, and acquisition price should be larger than $1 million because it's more significant acquisition. And we exclude the financial and public utility companies because it's kind of different animals, so we exclude. Okay, we match all the data from CompuSec, CRISP, and IQCOM, and we come out the sample size, the 3,688 observations. Okay, so here's our model. So we try to use the DID design because we think it's more supportive. So that's why we use the post 142. That's the indicator for period before and after standard adoption. And for goodwill indicator, we assume that goodwill for the treatment firm equal to one if the acquired firm have the goodwill already in their sample period. So that's why the firm, they already have goodwill, so they have to evaluate goodwill impairment every year, so they're more affected by 142 adoption. And all we can say that they are more, have to be more carefully to consider their next M&A decision. Okay. So for firms they don't have goodwill, they may not have that big pressure, or may not affect by 142 that more. So we separated to these two groups. And we do the interaction. We want to see the beta three, the interaction between the post and the goodwill treatment. Okay, so we control all the control variables for general typical acquisition performance. And by the way, acquisition performance, we use the announcement, the acquisition announcement abnormal return around 3 days for the acquired firm. And also we do the robustness check to construct the abnormal return across that around period for both the acquired and the target. And later on we'll do maybe our ROA to evaluate the M&A performance post M&A performance using our ROA. Okay. So this is all the control variable. And for the second hypothesis for our CEO overconfidence, we based on the prior literature, if they are quite confident in their ability and also their company, they usually hold the based on prior literature, they hold the in the money option without exercising it. They just keep in the money option for a long time period, and they don't really want to exercise it because they believe that the value of the company still keep going on or keep stay. So we use the major that we defined option in the money at least twice during the sample period, and then the CEO, they hold at least 2/3 of the in the money option. So we classify it as a CEO overconfident. Okay. So we also separate the sample into the two groups, the firm with the overconfident CEO and firm don't without overconfident CEO. So just skip here is our sample, the first H1. H1, we're showing that the firm, we kind of find the first, the post 142, the coefficient, the abnormal rate on abnormal return on coefficient on post is kind of significant positive. So of course it's kind of time trend, but we are just showing that after 142, the abnormal return kind of larger, acquisition performance kind of larger. And also for the interaction term, we find a significant positive at 1% and also 5%. So the... Okay. This is for the H1, and for H2, we also find that for the 142, they're kind of more disciplined for firm. They have overconfident CEO. So that's why we find a positive coefficient on the interaction turn for the two-way interaction or the three-way interaction turn. So that means the firm, they have overconfident CEO, but they have overconfident CEO. Usually they're aggressive or a little mindless to overestimate their ability, but after 142, they have to be more careful. So it's kind of disciplined that type of firm with overconfident CEO. And we do some additional tests for large goodwill impairment. So for example, large goodwill impairment, that's been usually implied that the CEO don't have ability or less ability or make poor M&A decision. Okay, so we showed that for those group after 142, actually the coefficient on the interaction turn is significant negative. That's mean after 142, that's make a poor M&A decision more significant. Because they show if they have big impaired, then they show that performance acquisition performance is less is negative. And also we want to see, because our argument is that the 142 does push the manager to acquire more information. So we classify the total sample into the acquire, the merge, the private company, and also the merge a public company. So we show that if the firm, they merge the private company, usually they don't have that much information around the market. So managers have to push themselves to acquire more information. So after 142, we actually showed that for firm, they acquire private company, they actually improve their acquisition performance more than public company. Okay. Yeah, we do some robustness check. So I just go back to, so I'm just saying that because there's interesting argument. Of course, I know nowadays almost all the countries, they use the impairment-only approach, even include the Japan, ISB, and US GAAP, but still there's still some argument and so, some improvement. So we want to show this type of research and kind of support. I think we kind of do research to support. But on the other side, as I mentioned, there's always an argument that too small, too little impairment, too small, too late impairment. And recently, I collect some information about a class action lawsuit. And from 2003 to 2020, actually 150 firm, public firm actually sued by the investors because of their delay, goodwill impairment. So there's still issues. So maybe we want to put some input and help to kind of improve this kind of standard. So that's why we do this project. Thank you so much.
I want to thank the organizer. Am I loud enough for giving me the opportunity to discuss this paper? I'm Jelena Andrejkovic, and I'm with Frankfurt School of Finance and Management.
Before I go into discussing the comments that I have for this paper, let me just briefly summarize the paper, even if I think Sofia did a great job at presenting it. So my reading of the paper is that the paper examines the effect of changes in financial reporting. Specifically, they look at SFAC 142 and how this affects market assessment of M&A. What the paper finds that firms or acquiring firms with goodwill balances, acquiring firms with overconfident CEOs and without goodwill impairment, they have better M&A quality. The channel through which this effect actually occurs is basically information hypothesis that states that after the implementation of SFAS 142, managers' information set improved. Okay, I think that the topic is highly relevant, especially if you consider that the goodwill accounting treatment is not without controversy. I think standard setters have long debated the accounting for goodwill, and more recently, both FASB and IASB actually consider going back to amortization. But as Florian mentioned at the very beginning, it seems that goodwill amortization does not offer incremental value over goodwill impairment. So in terms of comments, I'm going to structure my comments around four topics: motivation, mechanism, empirical strategy, and alternative stories. So when it comes to the motivation, I missed a clear discussion on the motivation of the paper, maybe except for a couple of lines that were also presenting on the paper on the fact that they are contributing to the debate on impairment-only approach. While I think that policy implications are important, I also believe that the paper has the potential to contribute to accounting literature by better positioning in the information hypothesis literature. The papers that I see most related to this current paper, and they were also mentioned in the presentation, is Schroff and Cheng. So what Schroff does, it basically, they look at 49 changes in accounting, 49 accounting changes, and they observe that after these changes, companies improve their investment in capital assets, but they see less, or the results are weaker when it comes to acquisition expenditure. When it comes to Cheng, what the paper does, so basically the paper utilizes the same setting as the current paper, and they show that after the implementation of SFAS 142, companies that are affected by SFAS 142, that is companies that have goodwill on their balances, they improve their management forecast accuracy. So I still think the paper has potential to differentiate itself from these current papers, because they are focusing on a different outcome, M&A decisions, and we've seen a lot of discussion on the presentation about how M&A decisions are important corporate events, different from investment in corporate assets and information provision. However, there is a recent paper, while the recent paper does not look at information information hypotheses, they do find that there is a significant increase in overbidding after SFAS 142. So I guess what the authors would like to do is to differentiate, or not differentiate, but at least reconcile the results of the two papers. When it comes to the mechanism, so while I acknowledge that managers' information sets are not observable, and we don't really know whether the managers actually increase their information set, I would like to see more information of what type of, I mean, I would like to see more discussion about what type of information do managers acquire that allows for a better valuation of the target. And if indeed the acquisition of such information actually ended up in having better M&A quality, why did the managers didn't acquire such information earlier? And by better linking the theory with the empirical design, the paper could better identify the mechanism at hand, basically information hypothesis. And they can do that by leveraging cross-sectional variations in different target characteristics that are related to difficult to value targets, right? And such characteristics could be targets' financial reporting quality, organizational complexity. I mean, the paper already has private targets, but I think they need to condition it first on the treatment effect, so they need to have a triple interaction or a subsample analysis. I believe there are two alternative mechanisms that the paper could try to discuss. The first one is that after SFAS 142, or SFAS 142 made poor acquisitions more visible because companies are required to disclose or are required to impair goodwill. And in doing so, managers would be less likely to pay, to overbid or to overprice or to pay a higher price for acquisition so that they're to avoid being punished by the market. A second mechanism could be that SFAS 142 does not change managers' information set, but rather it changes investors' information set. When it comes to empirical strategy, my main comment relate to the control group. And recall what the paper does. They basically look at the difference in difference research design, where they argue that the treatment group are firms with goodwill, and then control group would be firms without goodwill, right? But at the same time, these control groups that have goodwill, they also have to engage in M&A acquisitions. So they have to have M&A returns. So I'm really thinking, what is this group consisting of? Are they first-time acquirers? Did they never pay a purchase price higher than the fair value of the net identifiable assets? Did they have goodwill, but was that goodwill already impaired? But that's a bit tricky because somehow in the descriptive statistics, for the control sample, impaired has a 0.29 value, right? So they don't have goodwill, but they still have some sort of impairment going on. Also, I would like to see what is the control sample size. Based on my own calculation, it seems that there are only a few acquirers or a few observations in the post sample, right? So around, I know, 100 observations or something like this. Most of the observations actually are in the pre-period. What I would suggest alternatively, so the paper could look at European companies as a control sample, because in Europe, IAS 36 only enter into place in 2005. And in doing so, the paper could also, I mean, would like to keep only acquirers with acquisition both in pre and the post period, because otherwise you cannot actually identify the information hypothesis and the learning effect, right? So you have to have acquisition both in pre and post, and of course looking at the within firm estimation. Some potential alternative stories from that came to my mind is the results could actually be driven by concurrent regulation. If you think about SOX, they basically require the majority of the board of directors to be independent, and we know that corporate governance mechanism, they actually affect M&A quality. The variation in macroeconomic performance between the pre and the post period impact the quality of M&As, or in other words, even absent the regulation, we can still see differences in market assessment of M&A in pre versus the post period. And also the composition of the acquirers might change in the pre versus the post period, and thus firm characteristics might have changed between the two sample. I changed my mind about the decrease in overall number of acquisitions while coming or while I'm on my way here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm very bad at talking at the microphone.
Good morning. I'm Bob Yule with the ISB. Sorry I didn't know about slides, so I don't have slides for you. But hopefully I can still convey some of the thoughts. Thank you for the paper. I thought it was very interesting, very helpful. In thinking about this, it's also somewhat timely from a standard setter's perspective. And that both the FASB and the ISB recently looked at the issue of amortizing goodwill or not amortizing goodwill and the impairment tests, and can we improve the impairment tests? So, you know, this is good information for us. And so the coming conclusions that, you know, FAS 142 is working and IFRS standards are pretty similar to FAS 142, great support for us. And, you know, but before I stop there and just say, okay, we're done, you know, I'd kind of raise a couple of thoughts I had, you know, from coming from a perspective of a standard setter. The first one was 142 was implemented at the same time as FAS 141. So FAS 141, as you noted in the paper, required the acquisition method. So it eliminated pooling of interests. And so I struggled in thinking through, you know, could we say that in the paper that FAS 142 requires management to obtain better information about the target? I struggled with how to separate, because you focused on 142, how you separate 142 from the effects of 141, right? Because in pooling of interest, you just kind of brought everything over at carrying value. Now you bring purchase method, acquisition, that you did have purchase method, but I think you excluded that from the control group because I think the control group had no goodwill. So we moved to the acquisition method. So now management needs to think about, you know, bringing in all these intangibles. And so I struggled with, well, how much of the improvement in management obtaining information is really due to the impairment test in 142 versus the acquisition method in 141. Thinking about 142, and I appreciate the hypothesis and the findings you have. One thing that occurred to me, I think, would be a interesting follow-up, because your sample is right after the period of implementation of 142 and did not include, I think, the amendments to 142 to include step zero. So step zero now implements a qualitative test before you get to the two-step step one and step two. And so an interesting follow-up might be, well, how has in the implementation of step zero, doing that qualitative test, has that affected management's obtaining of information? Has it decreased or increased that, you know, for example, because now they get to do a qualitative test, don't have to actually go through the actual calculations of step one, does that decrease their pressure to obtain in the acquisition period all the information? The other, and so you also in that paper make three arguments that 142, it broadens the information set that management is looking at. It gets them, puts pressure on them to get better information about the nature and value of intangibles, and it highlights poor acquisitions. Understand all those kind of make sense, but again, I go back to how much of that was due to 141 versus 142. In looking at, it highlights poor acquisitions. One of the things we've been struggling with in a standard setting environment in looking at that, because we hear the arguments, the impairments are still, while better, are still coming too late. Is that really the best test for acquisitions? And that would be interesting, because we hear anecdotally there's over-optimism in these tests, that there is shielding in these tests, because once the acquirer allocates the goodwill to other units, to the reporting unit, and then it's added to that is the internally generated goodwill maybe from that reporting unit. I don't know how you would test for that, but that would be an interesting follow-up that, you know, from a standard setter, I would be interested in. The other thing that was brought up by the other presenter is, and I don't know how to control for this, but I just raise it, and how you would factor first in that sample period after the implementation, some outside factors, because I remember I'm old enough to have lived through that time. And I remember 2001, which is when this was implemented, there was a big event in the U.S., Enron. There was also right after waste management, after that was WorldCom. And so there was this big focus on, hey, management, you got to get better controls here. And that's what implemented SOX, and so there was controls. And so there was at that time other outside influences that caused management to really look at getting more information, having better controls around that information. There was also at that time, just before then, was the SEC and their earnings management. They issued three staff accounting bulletins around that. They were doing a lot of speeches. They were doing a lot of enforcement around earnings management. And so that also caused companies to put in better controls, think more about the information that they need, obtain, and their financial reporting. On the part about the your second hypothesis on the overconfident CEO, I understood how you define overconfident CEO. That made sense, and appreciated that your conclusions there too. But I come back to, well, because anecdotally we hear that in some cases there might be over-optimism in some of these impairment tests. And so would an overconfident CEO be more likely to put in over-optimistic factors into their impairment analysis and therefore not have as many impairments as another entity, and therefore affect the results? I don't know, and I don't know how you test for that. That's an enforcement issue. That's not, I don't know, as much of a standard setting issue, but just something I raised for your consideration. So those are the thoughts I had. Overall, thank you. I really enjoyed your paper. and hope these are helpful.